Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 338. Well, welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Tarullo. I serve as pastor of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Countryside, Illinois. And with me via the normal stream method, via internet, Zoom, all that kind of good stuff. Hey, Rob, how's it going?
Hi, but you failed to mention that I am in witness protection program.
Yes, right now. Yes. We cannot see Rob at the moment. He is just.
But I can see you.
He is just a screen, a little digital camera with an X through it. With a line slashed through it. So Rob can see me, but I can't see him.
Sure.
So that will aid in our doing a great job to know.
It's very spy-like.
Very spy-like. Sure. Rob's incognito today.
Sure. Yeah. And when you were gone, you know, we talk about this. When you were gone, there was something messed up with my computer that it wasn't, the connection with the internet wasn't that great. And then actually, because we didn't talk about this pre-show, my internet capability is back.
Okay.
Now that you're back from sabbatical, which is weird. But my camera's gone now.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, who knows? And I've been back from sabbatical. We've had some.
Oh, I know.
Okay. Because I thought you were talking about being back from my trip that I just got back from.
Right. Yes. That's right. Because you, what part of the world were you?
I was in Central Europe.
Seven continents yet?
I have not hit all seven continents. I don't think I will ever hit all seven continents. Because there's always one that's, you know, really, really far away and very cold, and only like spies go there and scientists. So, what's that?
Yeah. So where were you?
I was in Hungary. I went to Budapest and, another city called Miskolc, and, then down to, an area, called, Tihanya. Had a great time visiting my son who's studying mathematics there, and, with my wife. Through the International Conference of Reformed Churches, we know of a couple of churches in the area. My son goes to one that's in Budapest, and then there's another one in Miskolc, which is why we went there. It's about two hours away from Budapest, which I had met the pastor of that church at an ICRC conference, which is a, you know, like I said, an international conference of Reformed churches. It's a way for churches to be able to network and get a sense of the communion that we have, and help one another out, share resources, things of that nature. He invited me to preach, which was wonderful opportunity to go and be in his congregation and meet the members of his church. Thankfully, a lot of people in Hungary do speak English because, you know, I don't speak Hungarian. So that was made interacting with people much, much easier. There is a barrier there, obviously. It was a really, really sweet time of fellowship, getting to enjoy the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Central and Eastern Europe, so the RPCCEE. My son goes to the RPCCEE church in Budapest, and it was just really a wonderful time. Got to see a medieval castle up in Miskolc area. Got to see lots of sort of land filled with vineyards. There was a winery region that we drove through and visited. The city of Budapest itself is just a magnificently beautiful city, but there's also all sorts of remnants of the Soviet Union that's there. So the big block buildings and sort of the outskirts, yeah. But the interior of Budapest has those old kind of Hungarian and Austrian empire kind of buildings and such. So they had, Hungary had its millennial celebration in the 1890s as a people group, right?
Okay.
And so that's where a lot of the stuff that you see built in Budapest was built, was for that celebration. And so that's why it has that high kind of Western Europe feel to it, because of the just the opulent architecture that was going up at that time to celebrate their millennium as a kingdom. I mean, it's, and it's, you know, irony of history that it would only be a few decades later that after World War II that things kind of started falling apart, or not started falling apart, but after World War I and then World War II, things did fall apart. So, and you know, because Nazis came in, and then after the Nazis were pushed out, the Soviets came in and occupied them until the fall of the
yeah, so the early 90s.
Yeah, exactly. But they had a few revolts. They were much more independent mm-hmm. than other countries under Soviet rule, and so they had a revolt. Trying to think, it was 57 or 56. Mm-hmm. That's celebrated on October 23rd, which is when we were there. And so, you know, there is a national march, not march, I shouldn't say that. That's not the language. National
like
parade. Yeah. Okay. And there were rallies, because it is their political season as right now as well. So they're getting ready for an election next year. So the two opposing parties had their rallies going on. And so there was a lot of people in Budapest that actually aren't normally there. So it was quite the filled area. And interesting, when they celebrate this, they have their Hungarian flag up with a hole cut out of the middle of their flag. And that's where the Soviets had put their sickle and what is it?
The hammer and sickle.
The hammer and sickle. They had stamped that on the center of the Hungarian flag. And so as a sign of rebellion, they cut that out and they fly that flag all over the place on this day. I don't know if they do it other days, but on this particular day, it was definitely there. And so we walked over the famous chain bridge, beautiful bridge, and these flags were just lining the bridge on both sides. It was quite the spectacle of patriotism, kind of something you'd see here on, you know, 4th of July in all sorts of different cities and towns and everything. So yeah, it was a really, really wonderful place to go. There's a lot of good brothers and sisters there. You know, it's interestingly, it's a state church, and the state church is a Reformed church. Wow. But as you know, it's a liberal church now, which is why there's the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Central and Eastern Europe, because they had to pull away from it. It's a really, really fascinating part of the world. I mean, obviously it borders Ukraine, so there's lots of stuff going on there. Hungary used to be bigger, so there's lots of Hungarians that live in these other countries. It's a Hungarian speaking church. Anyway, I can go on and chat about it, because I've met some really good brothers, in that, denomination, and have been blessed by, interactions with them. And thankful for the opportunity to be there, and just, well, first, obviously, it's familial. See my son, visit there with my wife. I love food. Eat some great food.
You took a bath. I've been.
Well, I take baths regularly, Rob. Thank you very much. but yes, the geography of Hungary is unique in the sense as a really thin crust. You know, earth speaking, not thin crust pizza, Rob. And it's like a basin, like surrounded by mountains when you look at it at a larger scale. And so they have all these hot springs everywhere, and there's geysers and blown out geysers that, you know, meaning they don't actually work anymore, but there's these hot springs, that they've built up, and they've been doing it since the Roman times. The Romans came in and took advantage of it. The Turks came in when the Ottomans were had a portion of Hungary, and they have these opulent, beautiful bath systems where you just go and soak in mineral water, hot thermal baths that are just really, really comfortable. Goodness gracious, they're comfortable, and you know they all have some types of, as it's sold, you know, healing properties of one way or another. There's cold plunges. You move from a hot bath to a cooler bath. It feels like you're in freezing water, but you're not. We did that for one time that we were there, one portion of it. And I'd say it, that in and of itself is worth the trip. wow. So if you're ever in Europe and you're like, hey, what should we do today? That's one thing, that from my vast knowledge of traveling Europe, that I would say should be on the bucket list, of things to do, because it is quite an event. And you can make it more than we did, because we have limited financial resources and there's more to do that you could do if you have the abilities. But anywho, that's enough about me, Rob.
This episode brought to you by the Travel Channel.
No, it really was just a fantastic time, you know, 10 minutes into our conversation here. But
I was going to say, speaking of hot experiences.
You slayed me in the spirit here, Rob.
You like that?
I'm falling back in awe.
I know. So that's, we got to leave that up to us professionals. And yeah, because last time we spoke about the fiery furnace, and now moving on in Daniel, we are past that to talk about another dream that Nebuchadnezzar has had. But not just that, not just the dream. Then we'll actually talk about that next episode, the actual dream. But just Nebuchadnezzar and how he's interacting with Daniel and how he's interacting with God. Kind of what some of the things that he says about God and about his relationship to Daniel's God. The question about whether or not Nebuchadnezzar ends up a believer is kind of one of those questions that the church has discussed for a few thousand years. Did Nebuchadnezzar actually believe? Was he actually converted? And so I've wanted us to take a little deeper dive into that. Now, we're not going to come out and give a definitive answer that's going to solve the question, because people have been talking about it for a couple of thousand years. So obviously there is no 100% definitive answer. But the more I've looked into it, it really is interesting to see the way that Nebuchadnezzar and how he interacts with Daniel and God himself. And of course, again, next week we'll talk more about the dream and then what comes the actual results of God's judgment on Nebuchadnezzar and how that affects him in his relationship with God. But I was hoping, can you read the... we're going to talk about the first 18 verses in Daniel 4. And if you could lay that before us so we just have that in our heads.
Yeah. Okay. So we're at Daniel 4, beginning at verse 1, just reading through to verse 18. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation. The visions of my head as I lay in bed were these. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, "Chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, amid the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given it to him. And let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and gives it to whom he will, and sets over it the lowliest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you." So that's Daniel 4, 1 through 18.
I think one thing that's interesting about this is that, you know, here's Daniel writing his book, and under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. But in this, you know, in essence, he's quoting. I mean, this is Nebuchadnezzar that's issued this decree. This is the official court documents of Nebuchadnezzar that is being kind of transcribed into Daniel's book. And we see this other places in Scripture where other documents or speeches of pagans or just other officials are put right into the text. But it's interesting, you know, because we're kind of getting this from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective. And I just find that interesting when it comes to, is Nebuchadnezzar a believer or does he become a believer? And, you know, so how people that want to say, well, he is becoming a believer, even though it's talking in one sense like he's not. But this is the fact that we have him being quoted and that he calls Daniel's God the Most High God, or he uses that phrase, that kind of proves that he actually is a believer. What do you see? Do you think that's an indication?
Well, I guess what I was going to ask you, because, right, we just read Daniel 4. When I read that out loud like that to you, and you're reading along or you hear it, what is the indication to you? What says to you, ask the question, is he a Gentile believer in the one true God?
Well, for those who want to hold to that position, even at this point, they look at his phrase of the Most High God. He says that. He looks at Daniel's God as being powerful, as being, again, the Most High God. And maybe this is more of an American thing or maybe a Western culture thing, that we see the phrase Most High God, and we look at that indication as God being the only God, as there being no other gods before him, stuff like that. I think that's how we read it or how mm-hmm. we hear it. I don't think that's how Nebuchadnezzar's using it, but that is kind of how the argument goes, that because that phrase is used, that's the greatest indication that he actually is a believer.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if a recognition of Yahweh as being the Most High God means that someone is a believer, because you can hate the fact that he's the Most High God, right? Like Satan does. Satan knows that God is the Most High God and that he's the only God. Mm-hmm. Whereas, likely I would suggest that here, I think you suggested this as well, that Nebuchadnezzar is using it in the form of he's the Most High God among many gods, right? Because he's comes from a tradition of polytheism, of course, in some way or another. You know, there are tribal gods, national gods. That's the ancient Near East. So to recognize Daniel's God as the Most High God, right, at minimum, is suggesting, well, Daniel, your God, your national God, your God of Israel is the big guy on top among all the other tribal gods. So it could be indicating that. It doesn't necessarily indicate trust in that God, belief in that God, in the sense of, I love this God, and I'm going to serve this God and this God alone, which is what God requires of his people, which is what Yahweh requires of believers on him. Now, what's interesting is when you get down to like verse 8, and I think another place, and I'm not looking at this as someone who has done a great deal of study on this recently, but verse 8, there's a little note in the ESV, and I don't have my, goodness, I wish I had my other Bibles out, where it says the spirit of the holy gods, of holy gods. In the ESV, it says, or spirit of the holy God. So is he referring to, the polytheistic understanding of things, right? At last, Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar after the name of my God. So that's Nicodemus. Sorry. That's Nebuchadnezzar talking about his God, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. Is that how Nebuchadnezzar understood it? Or the spirit of the holy God? Is that how he's, which would then kind of indicate more of an understanding of, he's obviously polytheist because he's referring to my God and Daniel's God.
Right. Yes.
But the language of the spirit of the holy gods, or the spirit of the holy God, is interesting, and an interesting confusion or ambiguity, not necessarily confusion, but ambiguity as to, and I don't have the Hebrew up at the moment, it's probably Elohim, which is, we call the one true God Elohim, which is a plural form of God. And we translate it very often as God, singular. That's how we mostly do that. But here it may very well be that it is Elohim and it's translated gods, given the context of Nebuchadnezzar speaking. So, I'm looking at, the only thing I have up in front of me is the ESV Study Bible, and there's no comment on verse 8 as to that language. So unless I walk away from the mic for a moment.
Well, that's why it's so important that we understand that this is Nebuchadnezzar talking.
Yeah,
because we have to look at it as what is Nebuchadnezzar saying? Daniel is obviously giving us this is what Nebuchadnezzar has said, and he's letting us understand the context via Nebuchadnezzar's. But we have to understand his theological background, and Nebuchadnezzar he would have seen himself as the physical manifestation of Marduk or Murdoch, depending on how you pronounce it. And Marduk is the god who, so there's a pantheon of gods, and gods come into being in their religion. So they're kind of born. Gods are born, or they just appear. And so that's why when Nebuchadnezzar, who didn't know Daniel's God, is now, Daniel says to him, this is how I can interpret this dream, because my God has revealed, or God has revealed. Of course, Daniel's looking at being monotheist, saying, the God, the only true God has revealed this. And Nebuchadnezzar is hearing that, saying, oh, a new God has been born. A new God has come into existence. Wonderful. He accepts Yahweh as a God. And when he says, Nebuchadnezzar says, the Most High God, he's not referring to, this is in my, I'm no expert on this, it's just basic in the study I've done. He's not saying this is the top God. He's saying that Daniel's God is in the top tier of gods. because in the Babylonian religion, there were three top tier gods, and then there were three more under that, and then there were more under that, more under that. He's saying that Daniel's God, because of the fact that he was able to interpret the dream with the statue and all that, it amazed Nebuchadnezzar so much that obviously this Yahweh God must be a very powerful God. He's in that most high, the top tier status. And at some point, you know, like Nebuchadnezzar talks about his God and Daniel's God. And the thing about Marduk is that and this is with when you start looking at Babylonian religion, Bel and Marduk are kind of the same God. And all of this actually goes back to the Sumerian religion. So not Sumeria, but going back to when Abraham, where he lived, he comes out. Of course, that's the ancient Babylonians. And so Bel and Marduk are kind of the same guy. Nebuchadnezzar sees himself as Marduk, not just as his representative, but he's the representative on earth of Marduk, but he isn't in of himself, like part of the God. He looks at himself as the God. And one thing that Marduk does is there's chaos within the world. This is before humans existed. There's chaos. And when Marduk comes, he brings order from the chaos and actually destroys the God of chaos. And the way that he does that is he makes a deal with all the other gods that he'll bring order, but he becomes the top one. They're subservient to him. And what happens is with Marduk actually, and again, I know this is getting into the weeds here, but it helps us understand Nebuchadnezzar's thinking. Marduk eventually starts to absorb the other gods. So in the end, whenever that will be, there's actually one god remaining, and that's Marduk. Now, this is happening at the time. When Nebuchadnezzar is talking, there's many gods, but the top god, Marduk, is absorbing them. So he has no problem looking at Yahweh and giving him the highest honors, because that's what Marduk does. He gives honors. He is like a servant to the gods who then serve him and then eventually are absorbed into him. And one of the things I find very interesting in the speech he gives is he talks about the everlasting kingdom. That talking about Yahweh, he says his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Well, that to me, that's almost the greatest indicator. Oh my goodness, Nebuchadnezzar's become a believer, because he's looking at that as this everlasting kingdom. Well, only the true God is going to have an everlasting kingdom. But if we understand that for Nebuchadnezzar, all other gods are going to be absorbed into his God, he can say that about he can say any great thing about Yahweh, and it actually is referring to Marduk. It's referring to himself. Now, I think this changes in several chapters, after we all know what eventually that he gets, you know, puts as a beast. And after he comes out of that, he has been humbled. But I think it's helpful for us to understand what theologically Nebuchadnezzar is going to be humbled from. That he has no problem recognizing Yahweh as a God, but in the end, he is actually going to become greater than Yahweh. Sorry, go ahead. I went on a tangent.
Oh no worries. I think that's helpful. It's useful. It's meant for us to get a better sense of what potentially and likely is going on behind the scenes in the belief system, that as best as we're able to understand it. I think to a certain extent it aids in our understanding of you know, how we are to understand like what he thinks of the most holy God or the spirit of the holy gods, which I do think the plural form of that is the better rendition. Mm-hmm. Just I did, while you were chatting, was able to go over and look at the Hebrew for a bit and look at some comments on it. And it is not actually Elohim with an M sound at the end, but Elohim, which with an N as in Nancy at the end, which does change things up because of the plural adjective that comes after it. So in this Kadosh, Kodoshin, Kidoshin. Anyway, so for the Hebrew nerds out there, and they match up as a plural form, holy gods, instead of there being, which is typical, a singular, say, word for holy, and then put to the plural Elohim. So I do think, at least off the initial looking at this and a brief few comments, the spirit of the holy gods appears to be the better rendition than the spirit of the holy God. So, which puts it into the, I think, the same camp as what you were referring to there. You know, all else fails for Nebuchadnezzar in getting interpreters. It's no, he, you know, this is his second dream. He doesn't call out Daniel first. He goes to those people who failed him last time, the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astrologers. And then he brings in Daniel. Daniel, he kind of like, he worked well last time. And goes to Daniel after the fact, or after, you know, exhausting all other opportunities, and here he's like, oh yeah, he's the one who has the spirit of the holy gods working on his behalf.
What's interesting, because he doesn't do the death threat this time. Yeah, with all his people,
unless it goes unseen.
That could be. But I think we would have been told.
I think you're right. Yeah,
he doesn't do the death threat, but it really is interesting because it even says that Daniel is the head. Like, he's the top guy, but he's not called in with them. And I think, again, Nebuchadnezzar is still doing a test. Like, he knows Daniel's going to be able to tell him the dream because he already has. Daniel already has the ability to do it. Why? Because he has the spirit of the gods working through him. So he knows that Daniel's going to be able to do it. But all these other guys, these were the ones who would have said before the dream that almost got him killed, they would have said that they were in touch with the gods, that they were the ones that, oh yeah, we can interpret dreams. We have the ability. The gods are giving us the ability to interpret dreams. The problem last time was Nebuchadnezzar said, not only interpret the dream, but you tell me what the dream was.
Exactly, yeah.
And they couldn't do it, proving that they actually didn't have the connection with the gods that they had been telling him they had. But this time, you know, I think it's kind of like they've been called out. And so the reason why he doesn't do the death threat or tell them, because he also doesn't ask them to tell him the dream. He tells them the dream.
Yeah.
And whereas before, they used to, if he had told them the dream, they would have said, oh, absolutely. Oh, we totally know what this means. This is what it means. Da, 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 da. And then, with this one, because now they know that they're going to be held to account, that they better answer honestly. And they do. They say, we don't know what the interpretation is. And then he turns to Daniel. And I think it's very strategic on Nebuchadnezzar's part to keep you, because that's the thing. When you're a king, when you're somebody that can, with whatever decree you want, you can have whatever you want. Anyone you want to kill at any time, you can kill. You have that much complete authority, honesty from people who are subject to you is the one thing that you can never really rely on. Because how does he know that people aren't lying to him? But he's been able to, through all this, he's gotten the people that used to just spin him yarns to actually treat him with honesty. And I think he values that even on par with the fact that Daniel can interpret the dream that he's been in. Now he actually can trust these people. They don't have the ability they once said they did have, but at least he can trust them now.
Yeah,
that's very valuable.
Yeah, certainly. And he seems like, I mean, for all of the likely ruthlessness that a king of his era had, he is very concerned about the dreams he is having and what they mean for the future of his kingdom, as well as for himself. And so he wants to, he legitimately wants to know what these things mean. He is someone who appears to be very sensitive to his power and the longevity of his kingdom, to what extent that will continue. And so he wants to know legitimately, doesn't want, as you said, to be spun yarns. Because you'll note, I mean, we're not there at this one, but I do think it's quite interesting and telling. Daniel is a little hesitant about telling the interpretation of this dream in verse 19. At least this is how I'm reading, right? He's dismayed for a while.
Right. I think you're right.
And his thoughts alarmed him. Why? Well, because he's already been given the interpretation by the Lord. He's been the revelation has come to him. He knows what this dream means, and it means that his king, whom he has served for however many years thus far, is going to be, you know, go mad and act like an animal out in the trees and in the fields and for a season. And he doesn't want to tell the king that, right? He's alarmed by the ruler of this great empire is going to be in this situation, and that's not good for an empire. We've gone through a season of the questionable nature of the mental stability of leadership, and that's not good for a nation of any sort. But for an empire like this, right? Of course, that's not good. So, but then you know you just don't want to have to tell a guy he's going to act like an animal for a bit. Right, what's the king going to do to me? So he's alarmed and dismayed, but you see how the king says then in verse 19, you know, don't worry about it, okay? Just tell me. Now, I'm saying it with calm, right? You know, who knows what and the way in which Nebuchadnezzar is in his person and how he is handling these things. But as it's recorded for us, he's just like, you know, give me the bad news, or don't, you know, I'm not going to hold this against you, Daniel. Just get out with, you know, get on with it. Tell me what the Most High God is telling you to tell me now, and you'll be okay. So there's an apparent honesty to his desire to know what's going on, what's going to happen to him, what's going to happen to the kingdom, for whatever purpose, right? For whatever reason. There is a sincerity to it all.
Yeah, and you know, going back to Nebuchadnezzar's theological understanding, you know, as the representative of Marduk, who brings order out of chaos, and is actually the one who creates the land and the animals and humans, and is the one that brings prosperity in order to humanity and to the pantheon of gods as well. And that's kind of how this dream starts out, where, you know, as Nebuchadnezzar, as the ruler of the world, the known world at this time, what does he do? He is in charge of keeping order and subduing chaos and creating abundance for his empire. And so we have this great tree that fills the whole earth, and it's abundant with food for all the beasts of the field. They all take their shade. They come under the tree, and that's how they're fed by the tree, and they're protected by the tree, and they're given all these good things by the tree. And that's the Babylonian Empire. But who is the one that is in charge of that? That's Nebuchadnezzar. This is what Nebuchadnezzar is providing for all of his people, this great wealth and abundance. That's who he is. And if we look at the other dream, the statue, you know, this statue that talks about all these empires, well, who's the greatest empire? Well, it's Nebuchadnezzar, it's Babylon. Mm-hmm. He's the head of gold. And Daniel, sure, I mean, I think there's two things at play with Daniel being a bit apprehensive about telling him the dream. One is that he knows that while it's going to sound good at the beginning, it's going to end in bad news for the king, and the king could get angry and kill everybody. That's possible. But I also think that it's very possible that Daniel actually liked Nebuchadnezzar or had an affection for him. And whenever you have to bring bad news to somebody, you kind of feel bad about it. But if it's somebody that you're actually friends with, no matter what kind of degree that friendship is, well, it's much worse. That the fact that Daniel very well cared for Nebuchadnezzar and now is going to have to tell him that, look, King, you are the mighty provider and protector of the world, and you're going to be cut down to the realm of an animal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we call it as Christians. It's hard providence, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's something that we don't always understand why, right? Because it's a quote-unquote evil empire, right? They do bad things, but they're protecting many at the same time. So that's the nature of empires. There's a lot of bad stuff that happens in order to get big, and order to maintain rule, but within that, people are able to live life, generally speaking, in a particular way that allows for prosperity. At least this is how it's supposed to work. And so, you know, that's the language. You know, this thing is shading. People live under the shade of it, under the authority of Nebuchadnezzar. And then here comes the Lord, and he's going to chop it down. Well, that means a lack of safety, a lack of care, a lack of provision for so many who relied upon that stability and that relative safety. And to a certain extent, right, I mean, when things have come about of that instability, that lack of care and security, we're meant to be pressed to the one who can never be cut down. We're meant to be pressed to the one who is the Most High, not who some, you know, God who's going to be absorbed into, you know, another God. We're pressed to the one who is the rock, the security, the creator, the redeemer. And that's not what happens, at least with most empires, right? They get cut down and people flee, and then they seek refuge in another kingdom. And that's what happened in Israel's history over and over again, right? They fled to the wrong protector over and over again, whether it be Israel or Judah. They fled to nations. They looked to this world for their security and their safety. And that is what eventually led to God bringing them out of the land into exile, into the hands of Babylon, into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. Hence, now we have these interactions between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, the king over all of this large and vast empire. So it's all sorts of interesting and wonderful in the way in which God moves through reveals these things to us through Daniel. Because if you go ahead and read like Jeremiah, and you have just this the weeping of this prophet throughout, and you see the reason for all of this. This exile comes through the prophet Jeremiah, which is just tremendously devastating. And you see how much God is jealous for his people, and yet they continually turn and turn away from him. And he just outlines over and over again, delineates their sins against him, and why this exile is taking place. And yet here we have this interaction between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, just telling us about, you know, kingdoms coming, kingdoms falling. Nebuchadnezzar, the leader, is going to become no longer like a man, but like an animal, mm-hmm. A beast of the field. It's just, it's all sorts of fascinating that this is, all of it is meant to press we who have this as an example for ourselves. Now, there's prophecy here, of course, as well, that is drawing us and turning our attention to how God works in this period of time that we're currently in. of course, you know, Daniel matching up with so many aspects of the fulfillment of Revelation and coming, yeah. You know, Book of Revelation and such. But also just of living in a foreign land, living with eyes set upon our God, living by faith and not by sight, not it's not that we're not concerned with the city in which we live, of course, right? Jeremiah says, be concerned for the welfare of the city that you live in, right? Babylon. Seek its prosperity. And we do that in our own land. We want, right, the land in which each of our, wherever Christians live, they should be seeking the prosperity and the welfare of their own nation. And that would be, you know, through the proclamation of the gospel first and foremost. And seeking to bear witness to the good news of the gospel and what Jesus Christ has done to bring this new life to this empire of heaven, right? Kingdom of heaven, to bear on this earth through the saving work of Jesus Christ. So anyway, there's just so much wonderful, interesting aspects of Daniel that sometimes I think we can just sort of go over because and not delve down into deeply because of all the debates about prophecy and such today and all the, you know, just how it can be a little confusion, not just a little, it can be confusing. You know, as you said, people have been discussing for 1,000 years, is Nebuchadnezzar a believer or not a believer? Well, in the end, does it really matter? I mean, you can have those discussions, but does that matter? I don't know. Maybe there are indications that he was, maybe there are indications that he wasn't, maybe the absolute humiliation and humbling of the things that he goes through does make him a believer. I think in the words that you were saying, it sounded as though you're convinced of that as he does later on, that he is someone who becomes a believer. But in the end, these are just a wonderful text. Just, I don't know. Sorry.
Well,
now I'm the one who went off.
I'll hold off on giving where I lean.
Oh, okay.
We can wait a couple.
It's
weeks.
It's a mystery.
But I will say, we'll talk about another a couple weeks. But I will say that whether or not he was isn't what helps us in our study of Daniel. And like you said, even the Book of Revelation, because there's such a correlation between the two. What helps us is understanding what God is teaching us and Nebuchadnezzar through the dreams, through the judgment that's coming of him being made into like an animal.
Mm-hmm.
What we are being taught is the most important. I think it's perfectly fine to speculate about whether or not he was a believer.
Sure, yeah.
We shouldn't ignore that, but whether or not he was isn't the main point. The main point is where the way paganism has portrayed gods throughout, I would say, since the fall, and how the one true God often steps in to completely destroy the thinking behind it. Look at Egypt, 10 plagues, all targeting a certain god of Egypt. It there is no god but one god. The Israelites would eventually face exile because of worshiping false gods, and the mocking of the one true God, saying you cut down a tree and you take a piece of wood and half of it you create a god that you bow down and worship, and the other half you put on your fire so you can make your food. Just the absurdity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the important things that's happening here is how Nebuchadnezzar understands his theology, the theology of Babylonia, which of course which we don't have time to get into, but goes back to the Sumerian, which is that civilization, which is what Babylon is kind of related to. That religion that permeated the ancient Near Eastern cultures, that most of the Old Testament and even the New Testament with Rome, because it all develops into the pantheon of Rome, right? We see this culmination of them taking all the gods of all the places that they have they've conquered, and they just say, okay, worship them all, which is very much like what Nebuchadnezzar's religion is, that God, there can be, you know, thousands of gods. They just come into being and we'll accept them all. But of course, if for Nebuchadnezzar, eventually it's only him or his God that absorbs all the other ones. So, you know, he sees himself as the top dog, right? But he has no problem with all these other very powerful gods. And it's interesting when we go back to the Sumerian civilization and the Epic of Gilgamesh, the idea of the flood, which, you know, all these ancient Near Eastern cultures had their own version of the flood story. Of course, we know that this is their understanding of what we have in Genesis with Noah and that flood. But one thing that the Epic of Gilgamesh does is it tells us that there was this great religious understanding pre-flood, and that the Sumerian civilization after the flood is what has been built to reconstruct not just buildings and a people civilization, but that ancient religion as well. And it just reflects what Satan has tried to do since the garden, create a false religion that is completely opposed to the true understanding of Yahweh, to the true religion, to what is true, and to create something false. And while, again, I'm not saying this is my impression, I want to say that. I'm not saying I'm, you know, an expert on all this, but my impression with Babylonian religion, it's interesting, and it goes back to Sumerian religion as well, that there is this god of chaos that is destroyed by these other gods. And I think that that is Satan. That's how he looks at it. The god of chaos is the one true God. And he is going to destroy the one true God. You know, the true God brings chaos, but the new God, Satan, is gonna be the one that brings order. He'll destroy the chaos of God, and he'll bring true order. And it's nothing but a falsehood that he's been trying to deliver to mankind since the garden. Hath God said? No. God doesn't. You won't die, because God knows that actually you truly will be whole. Your eyes will be opened if you just do what he has said not to do. He's trying to withhold this from you. It's Satan's aim is to destroy the true God, and that's, you know, in all false religions, we always see a false religion or a false theological understanding of a God or the true many gods. We always see that as being opposed to the one true God.
Well, thanks again for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Of course, you can find us at reformedforum.org. And you can find all sorts of wonderful resources there at Reformed Forum. You can take a look at the 2025 Annual Theology Conference addresses. They're now there at the website, or you can check them out at YouTube as well. Wonderful opportunities to take some classes through Reformed Academy. There are great courses there, some new things, some new publications that you might want to check out there as well. You can also check out the congregation that Rob and I serve. You can go to westminsteropc.org, and you'll find all sorts of resources there, actually. Some introductory videos from myself and our other pastor, David Wright, just to get to know our congregation. And do just come visit with us. It's always great to have people that are listeners come and visit, say hello. And if you know other people in the Chicagoland area that are looking for a good church, do point them in our direction. We love to meet new people. Also, let's see. What was I thinking, Rob? What's up next?
Well, next week we're going to party like an animal with Nebuchadnezzar.
Where did you come up with this stuff?
Oh, you don't want to look inside this head.
All right. Well, with that said, it was good. I can't even know what to say. Once again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.